Okie dokie, welcome to lecture 14. We're going to talk about a hodgepodge of things. We're going to talk about some routing table stuff, which we kind of covered, but I want to fill in some blanks on routing protocols. Do you want your charger, Grace? And you want... we're going to talk a little bit about, as I said, the routing tables, then we're going to go and talk about the data link layer. And we're going to talk about, what the layer 2 stuff and that, which was the labs that have been modified and how those relate and all of that sort of good stuff. Now, I've got most people's routing labs. I haven't marked most people's routing labs yet, although I'm getting very close to it. How does everybody feel about their understanding of IPv4 routing tables? With a sub-note that the IPv6 chat and the resources for said chat have gone up. And if you're interested in IPv6, you really should go get them.
Kerry, which routing labs are you talking about? Which labs were those?
The one where you make the routing table for Sydney, Brisbane, Darwin, Perth, that one?
Oh, okay, that one. All right.
Okay, so how's everybody feel? Is everybody think they're familiar with the way... Well, it's going to sneeze soon. Routing tables and stuff are set up. There we go. All good. So everybody's good with routing tables, or everybody's not good with routing tables? The whole subnet mask and what scope it takes up and the anding and the gateways and all that sort of thing?
No, I think it makes sense to me.
Alrighty. What I want to talk about is... yes, last week you guys set up a topology using RIP, which is the routing information protocol. Now, there are a number of different routing protocols that we talked about, RIP, BGP, OSPF, EIGRP, ISIS, and there's one I can't remember. And the point with those routing protocols is that metrics are advertised. A metric is how expensive a route is, as I've spoken about. Generally speaking, static routes are advertised with a metric that is lower than dynamic routes, and depending on the routing protocol depends on the offset to the metrics that is advertised. So you can prefer OSPF routes over RIP routes and that sort of thing. So the cost of the route is important, and the cost that is advertised will depend on which routing protocol is in use and how the administrator has set it up. Now, you can override those metrics. Those metrics are not set in stone. The other thing is, when you set up routing protocols, there is the option of redistributing routes via a routing protocol. So if you go into global configuration mode and do a redistribute static, if you go router RIP redistribute static, it will actually distribute any static routes or directly connected routes via RIP, and that is sometimes important, because if you don't do that, those routes aren't always advertised. Use Alex's second one in on the other side. Okay, so everybody good with the metrics and stuff? I mean, obviously, until you guys are actually routing things specifically, you'll get experience when you actually do this in real life. But if you are, obviously, this is all a bit theoretical at the moment. Alrighty, let's get into Module 7, and we'll rip through this. The first thing they do is summarize all the layers that they've done so far, which is always useful. Application layer provides interface to user. They're just re-summarizing these so you guys remember. Transport layer provides communication between systems and manages the communications between the end systems. The network layer allows the traffic to travel across the network, and the data link layer is the bridge between the network and the physical layer. We're going to explain the role of data link layer protocols, describe the data link layer and how it relates to media, different types of media access control methods, and identify various logical network topologies. Okay. Now, the data link layer concerns itself with media access techniques and error detection. So, basically, what you're looking at is... Grace, do you want a soundbar? Soundbar?
No.
Okay. So basically, we are talking about frames. Frames are what exist on Ethernet. They are what exists on wireless networks. They are what exists on ATM. We are concerning ourselves with which type of addresses, if we're talking network topology. What sort of addresses are relevant at the data link layer?
MAC addresses.
Yay, MAC addresses. And we are talking about nodes at this layer. We're not talking about hosts. We're talking about nodes and end devices. Now, we're talking about the physical network, which is how the cables are actually set up, fiber, wires, wireless, whatever. We're not really talking about the logical network at this level. And the logical network is how it's arranged with the hierarchical addresses, which is up on your layer 3 and your IP addresses and all that sort of good stuff. Now, the point of the data link layer allows things to put things onto the network without concerning themselves with the media and its characteristics. So if you look at the TCP/IP layer, TCP/IP model, you have the network access layer, you have the network layer, you have the transport layer, and you have the application layer. The network access layer is sort of data link down. It doesn't really concern it. It concerns itself with how things are going to get from one end to the other, and how these things are going to sort of interoperate. Now, data link layer frames. Hang on, Grace, there's real speak on there. Cool. The data link layer governs how you format the frames for different media. So if you're looking at PPP frames, they're not the same as Ethernet frames. If you're looking at... And in fact, Ethernet frames aren't the same as wireless network frames. There are actually special frames for wireless network that look different. The fact is that when you guys plug in an access point, you don't necessarily see that because the translation happens automatically. But if you actually run Linux and Kismet, you can actually see the contents of the wireless frames. And there, I think there is one network adapter for Windows PCs that will allow you to see those wireless frames in their raw form without them being processed by the drivers. Now, obviously a device has a card that controls the media access and framing, or it has the circuitry that controls it. So you're looking at you know, network cards are embedded in things and those sorts of things. Now, a frame has header, data, and a trailer. So if you're looking at Ethernet frames, you've got a header and you've got a destination MAC address, a source MAC address, you have a protocol type, you have the 64 bits of preamble, you have the data length slash type field, and you have the payload, and then you have the cyclic redundancy check. Now, can anybody tell me why does the destination MAC address come first?
So that because, the node can identify right away if it's intended for itself, so it doesn't have to read the rest of the frame if it's not intended.
Did I talk about the different type of switching previously? Did I talk about store and forward, cut through and fragment free?
No.
Ah, no. I probably should. Okay. This is a little bit of a garden path, but if you look at, there are three different types of switches. Now, we all know a switch is one of those boxes that's got lots of network ports in it, and you plug everything in and it all just goes. And people understand that a switch only transmit packets out the ports that they need to go, and they learn the topology and which MAC address is on which port, and they build a CAM port, which is content address memory. They actually learn which MAC addresses exist on which ports, and unless the packet is a broadcast, they only send the packet to the destination address of the machine where that machine is actually sitting port-wise. Interesting point. If a switch has never seen a packet on has never seen a MAC address before, what happens to the first frame that comes from that MAC address? Can anybody tell me?
Does it sense all the ports?
Yes, it certainly does. Everybody happy with that? Like, everybody understand why that would happen?
So that it can determine which port is assigned to that MAC address?
No, the actual reason is because it doesn't know. And until it sees a frame from a particular port, it doesn't know. So it needs to learn, it needs to see a packet from the particular host so it can learn which port that host is connected to.
So if you had a host plugged into the switch in, say, port 5, and then you unplugged that and plugged in something else, would it then clear its buffer for port 5 and then just change over to the new MAC address for that port?
Well, depending on the type of switch you've got, you can actually have multiple MAC addresses per port. For example, if you daisy chain switches, it's possible to have 10 MAC addresses sitting on one port. So what the switch usually does is it memorizes what the addresses are, and it then changes its idea of the addresses when it sees changes on the topology. Now, you've all seen switches. Everybody's seen a switch. Nobody hasn't seen a switch. Stuart Moi, I think his name is. John, have you got an internet router at home? Like, what does your internet plug into?
Yeah, I was going to say that, I guess. I thought of that after I sent the chat, that I do have a... it's from my ISP, but it has four Ethernet ports and then wireless off of it. So I guess that would be technically a switch, right?
It certainly would be. And if you've seen one of those, you have seen a switch. Now, there are three types of switches, and this does sort of cover into the data link layer, so this is why I'm talking about it now, because it will come up later on in the course and stuff. But there are three types of switches. The cheapy ones, which are like the ones John's got, not to pick on John, but it's the ones like the ones that lots of people have. They are store and forward. So what happens is they receive the entire packet, they look at the destination MAC address, they put the entry into their CAM table, content address memory table, and they then forward the packet out the necessary port that it's meant to go out. Can anybody tell me what might be a problem with store and forward switching?
I would say, like, bandwidth issues, because the packets could potentially bottleneck in the switch.
They could potentially do that. Can anybody tell me another problem with store and forward switching? Let me give you a hint. Store and forward. Store and forward. Anybody got any ideas?
Something might happen when it's being stored and they get lost.
Yeah, possibly. Buffer problems. Guys, what about latency? If you're going to stick around until the entire packet's received and you're going to store it and then you're going to forward it, don't you think things are going to slow down a bit? Now, on a home network, you don't notice. You really don't notice. It's It's when your network's low down, it's when you've got lots of hosts, it's when you've got lots and lots of traffic going all over the place that this becomes a problem. So you've basically got you've got store and forward. You've then got what we call cut-through switching. Now what happens with cut-through switching is the switch reads the packet, it then reads the packet up to the point of the destination MAC address, which comes first, which is where I got up to. It then cuts the packet through to the port that it needs to go to, and it reads and sends the remainder of the packet out the port once it's actually cut the switch across. Everyone cool with that one? Okie dokie. And fragment free, I can't actually remember, so we'll have to Wikipedia that up. I can't remember the specifics of fragment free, so we'll come back to that one. Okie dokie. Okay, now some of the things that frames can contain, and we are talking about Ethernet frames here, we're talking about... Sorry? Go ahead, Corey. Oh, you're just keyed up. Okay, it's all good. We can have start and stop indicator frames. So if you're talking about Ethernet, you have a start indicator of a preamble, and the preamble is 64 bits long. It's an alternating pattern of 62 zeros and ones followed by two ones. So that is that's your preamble on Ethernet. You can have naming or addressing fields. Now some frames do have names in them, some of them have addresses. It just depends on the type of network and type of protocols. The type field, now on Ethernet, that can either be a type or length field. If it is under 1500, it is a length field, 1500 or below. If it is, or 600 hex, I think they said. What's that give us? 512.102.4. Yeah, if it's under 1536, it is a length field, and if it is over 1536, it is actually a protocol identifier field. And I think one of your labs talks about how all of the TCP/IP traffic is all set with 0x800 or something for the protocol field in all of the frames. You can also have flow control services in the data link layer, and there are flow control services on Ethernet that can actually slow traffic down and stuff, so if switches and things busy can actually get busy, they can actually do back pressure flow control and slow down the actual transmissions to a degree. Obviously the data, that's also important to send in these frames, otherwise what would be the point really? The data link layer is broken into two sublayers. We have LLC, which is logical link control, and we have the media access control layer. And this is so that you can have like more than one protocol on the same wire. So you can run IPX, SPX, and TCP on the same network. I don't know whether anybody remembers the bad old days of DOS, but we used to actually have a rule of one protocol stack per card, and that could get quite tedious. Now the logical link control, it frames the packet, identifies the network layer protocol, which was that identifier field I talked about earlier on Ethernet. Now if you really want to know about how Ethernet works, there is actually a book called Ethernet: The Definitive Guide by O'Reilly. It's really good, but it will put you to sleep. Now your media access control sublayer addresses the frame, so they're your MAC addresses that we're talking about, marks the beginning and end of the frame, and that's what it does. Media access control, have we talked about carrier sense multiple access with collision detection yet?
No.
Alright. Does anybody know about CSMACD? Or shall I go in and talk about it?
It deals with...
Okay. Carrier sense multiple access with collision detection is what we use on Ethernet to allow multiple access to the medium by a series of stations. Back in the 70s, there was a networking thing on the Hawaiian Islands called Aloha, and basically on that network they would wait for a period of silence. They would then transmit, and if they detected another station transmitting on the medium, they would stop transmitting for a random amount of time and then retry their transmission. I used to joke that they would do it so that they could see which island had the most pineapples, but I am now informed that they do not grow pineapples in Hawaii anymore. Now, when Ethernet first came out, we were running it on 10Base2, 10Base5 coax. You had a shared bus between all of the computers, so you had, for example, with 10Base2, you had Terminator, T-Piece, coax, T-Piece, coax, T-Piece, coax, T-Piece, Terminator, and you would plug the bottom of the T-Pieces into all the computers, and if you sent a packet on the coax, every machine would see it. So what happens in Ethernet is the computer waits for a period of silence, it detects whether somebody's transmitting. If somebody is not transmitting, they send a packet. If two machines fire up at the same time and you see an increased voltage, which is considered a collision, a jam signal is then sent to tell everybody that they are dealing with a situation where we've had a collision, and then there is a random back-off, exponential back-off algorithm that comes into play. If you are unable to send a packet for 16 times, the packet is actually discarded in this particular topology. Can anybody tell me why this is not as relevant as it once was now?
Switch.
Kind of. That's part of it. Anybody else got any ideas why this wouldn't be as relevant as it once was? If you have a full duplex transmission medium, you can send and receive at the same time. And the fact is, you don't. The switches will, of course, buffer packets up and make sure that you don't get collisions. But in a full duplex system, you can actually send and receive at the same time. Therefore, you do not have collisions. Mate, I'd be making him look it up with the Jaws cursor and turning his screen off. Oh, okay. Oh, fair enough.
Is that just because of the way Ethernet is wired? Because obviously with the coax, there's only the one line, essentially, whereas Ethernet is composed of several little wires bundled together so they can transmit on one line and receive on another?
Yeah, pretty much. And with 100 megabit Ethernet, you've got your send pairs and you've got your receive pairs. And obviously that's, you can send and receive at the same time, so therefore you don't tend to have you don't tend to have collisions. Now, the RFCs do not define the data link layer. The data link layer, the RFCs being the documents that deal with internet protocols and the request for comments on said protocols, they basically do not do this Ethernet stuff. That is done by a number of organizations. It used to be Xerox, Intel, DEC, and somebody else that I can't remember. However, there are more organizations that do Ethernet, as you would well know, because Ethernet is incredibly ubiquitous. Oh, look, there's a list of them in my notes here. I should have read down lower. International Organization for Standardization, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. Try saying that three times after you've had six shots of vodka. American National Standards Institute, or ANSI. ITU, or International Telecommunications Union, and that is the list of some of the organizations that are involved in these data link layer standards. Okay, now the thing I didn't mention is that there are two types of media access control. There is deterministic and there is non-deterministic. Non-deterministic means that you cannot be sure those instructions are out of date. You need to open a telnet session to 192.168.100.144 internally. Yeah, and it's got to be telnet. Yeah, we should. Okay, so non-deterministic means that there is no guarantee that you can access to the media. If the media jams up or it fills up, you're not going to get access, and you're not sure when you're going to get access. Deterministic is where you do know what probability you're going to have of getting access to the medium and what level of bandwidth you're going to have. And systems that use deterministic are things like Token Ring. And is FDDI deterministic, Ian, or not? FDDI. Yes, okay, and FDDI. Sorry, I was just finding out whether FDDI was deterministic as well. 144. Okay, and I have notes on the stuff I just talked about. Did people want me to start sending my lecture notes out after each lecture? Because I had sort of said that I was going to, but I haven't. Do people want me to actually do that? Because I did send you guys notes 1 week, but I wasn't sure whether anybody found them any good.
Oh yeah, I thought it was...
I found them useful, yeah. I thought maybe you had an issue against, and we should all be taking our own notes, but if you're willing to supplement, yours are better.
Yeah, look, you guys probably should be taking your own notes. Basically, if you read my notes and then you say that there's something not in the test and it's all my fault, I'm going to laugh at you and go, well, you should have read the actual lecture notes. Now, I'm happy to provide my notes, but if you guys don't read the chapters, which is, doesn't go for anybody on here, but if you don't read the chapters and just read my notes, then you get what you deserve, I'm sorry, because I don't claim to cover everything, because I only pull the things out of the chapter that I deem as important, which is not the list of the things that you don't understand. Okay, disclaimer ends. You guys get the idea.
Even when you do read the complete chapter, the exams have a very funny way of altering the phrasing of things, so it doesn't appear to be the same content that you read.
Oh, yeah, don't I know it. It's not a huge amount. No. Point-to-point links do not require control rules, generally speaking. So you don't necessarily need to control on a point-to-point link because it's one packet after another. Okay, anybody want to define the difference between full and half duplex?
Full duplex lets you communicate in both directions at the same time or with multiple connections, whereas half duplex it's just one connection at a time, or one packet, I should say.
No, half duplex is one direction at a time only. What's the matter, Grace? Is it working? Devices that are full and half duplex, can anybody think of a device that is half duplex? That is to say, it either sends or it receives.
Old satellite links.
Yeah, old satellite links. Anybody else got any examples of half duplex?
Lots of radio communication.
Yes. Wireless networks are half duplex. Anybody noticed how the speed on their wireless network is really slow, comparatively speaking, to Ethernet? And when you start doing a few things at once, things just really bog down. That's because your little wireless radio can only either send or receive, and it can only do one at a time, and it takes time to switch between one mode and the other. Okay, logical versus physical topology. The logical topology is how the network is laid out as far as the data link layer and stuff is concerned. Control shift 6, Ian. If you can do that on the Mac, we'll stop that. So logical topology, I'm just trying to think of where you got a difference between logical and a physical topology. You can have a logical topology of a ring for token ring, but the physical topology, it's actually wired up in a bus configuration. The other way you can think of a difference between logical and physical topology is physically a switch is a star, but logically it's a bus because every other machine can see every other machine. Okay, now there are different layouts for networks. You've got bus, star, ring, and mesh. A bus is where everything is connected. Like if you picture a bus, it starts off at the bus depot, and it goes brum brum brum. Cavi and Cavi. Well, username Cavi, password Cavi. It's the same for the super user password. Sorry, they're playing with the remote bundle.
We've got to get you your private office, Gary.
I would love a private office, but, you know, it's a big room, and things happen, and people ask me things. And I feel like I'm trying to half-duplex, you know, multiplex here, and it's exciting. The only reason I don't lecture from home is because when the remote bundle breaks, guess who gets to fix it?
It's not easy being popular.
It's all right. I'll manage somehow. Okay, so bus topology, right? You've got a bus. It leaves from the bus depot. Brum, brum, brum. Picks up lots of people. Goes to the end of its bus route. It turns around. Brum, brum, brum. Comes back to the bus depot. And it travels along one route. We're just going to keep this simple, okay? So if you have a coax network, and I'm just gonna ditch. Do you want this, Grace? Okay, there we go. Apparently, it pays to be popular as well. Grace is popular. Okie dokie. Now, a ring topology, it looks like a ring. Things go round and round in circles. So you've got a loop and the packets travel around the ring. If you have a token ring network, you can either have a single ring, and then if the ring breaks, everything stops. And if you have a double ring, like on FDDI, the packets travel around in both directions, so they go clockwise and anti-clockwise. And if the ring breaks, it can actually pick up where the ring has broken, and it can figure out what is going on.
Kerry, just as a quick question, at one point in my history of scavenging computer parts from such places, I came across some network cards which had the standard Ethernet connector, but also kind of a round coaxial-ish looking thing that you could screw into it. Is that a token ring connector?
No, that is coax. That is your 10-base-2. Do you want that back on charge, Grace, and I'll answer it and hand it to you? Or are you right? Oh, she's walked out. Okay.
So how old would that be? Like, because I know these are only, like, these are PCI cards, but they're, like, pretty old.
They would be Realtek 8029 cards, and they have an RJ45, and they have a 10-base-2 connector on it, and they are 10 megabit per second cards. I was putting those in workstations back in the late 90s, probably 98, 99, 97. That's sort of the era that you're looking at.
Okay, sorry to interrupt, but thanks. Just thought I'd ask while we're at it.
Oh, look, no problems at all. Another multitask thread is not an issue. Now, so you've got your bus and you've got a ring. Now, a star is where you have like a central connecting device and you have everything hanging out in a star pattern all around it. An example of star is things connecting into a switch. You have all the different cables running off in all different directions to said devices. Now, a mesh is where you have every station connected to every other workstation. So if you think a bit like chicken wire. It is used for ultra-reliable systems. And the example they give in the notes is control systems in nuclear reactors. We don't want those failing too often. Okie dokie. Multi-access topology needs media control method. I think I've covered that, so we don't need to go into that too much more. Now, in a token ring network or FDDI or whatever, what actually happens is you have a token, which is a bit like a message stick or something. The if you've got four machines in a ring and it's a single ring, the token goes from machine 1 to machine 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, and that basically then goes from 4 to 1, which is obviously, you know, it's passed around. Now, when a machine gets the token, so machine 1 has nothing to transmit, it passes the token to machine 2. Machine 2 has nothing to transmit, it passes the token to machine 3. Machine 3 has something to transmit. It says, I want to tell machine 1 something. It loads the token with data, sends it to machine 4. Machine 4 hands it to machine 1. So that is token passing. You don't see a lot of token ring these days. You can always recognize a token ring network card by the fact that it has two connectors on it. One for in and one for out.
I was just going to ask you if there's a particular application where that would be desirable over the other architectures today.
I think some banks used to use it. No, I don't know where Grace is. It's alright, just letting you know. No idea. Some banks use token ring and stuff because it has deterministic access, and when you are dealing with high levels and high volumes of transactions, you can be assured that you will get access to the infrastructure. Okay. Now, my notes say here, depending on the type of environment, the level of error checking and the overhead required to do that error checking differs. So it depends on how important error checking is to you. Done the stuff that's in the frame. So we've got start frame, delimiter, sourced and destination addresses, priority and quality of service, if you've got that implemented. There is a priority field on Ethernet. It depends on whether your underlying cards and switches implement it as to how utilized it is. Type field, we've talked about that. In other words, what the upper level protocols are. Some of them have a logical connection field. Physical link fields, but Ethernet doesn't tend to have that. Flow control and congestion. Now, not all protocols have congestion control, and sometimes that's handled at higher layers. If we're dealing with TCP/IP, the congestion control is handled at the transport layer. Now, the point that's important here is physical addresses are used on the data link layer, so you're looking at MAC addresses and those sorts of things. If you are looking at... these are not hierarchical. So, as we spoke about MAC addresses, they're 48 bits long, 24 bits unique organizational identifier, 24-bit station identifier, or a serial number. You can't tell where machines are based on their MAC address. You know that they're all on the one segment, but it doesn't actually tell you how that segment is laid out, which is important. Now, this does come up in your Cisco tests around about the point. Physical addresses are removed from packets when they are forwarded over a router, and they are re-added when they go to another router. So, here's a question for you. We have the accounting LAN and the admin LAN connected by a router. If workstation 1 with MAC address 1234 sends a packet to workstation 5678, from the accounting LAN to the admin LAN, which MAC address will be on the packet when it ends up on segment 2? Which device or which sort of MAC address will be tied to that packet? Anybody got any idea?
Wouldn't it be the routers?
That is 100% correct. It would be interface 2 of the router's MAC address. In other words, the interface that is connected to the admin LAN. Has anyone seen those horrific questions where they've got like this router's connected to that router and that router's connected to this router and this router's got this MAC address and that router's got that MAC address and that other router's got that MAC address, and if we send a packet from San Francisco to Los Angeles, what will be the MAC address on this one?
Don't remind me.
I just did. Let me warn you guys, this is in the final and it's a doozy. Okay, so you've got to understand when the MAC address changes and when the MAC address doesn't. And yes, there is an infernal diagram description that will turn your brain inside out that says this router talks to this router that talks to this router that talks to this router. What MAC address have you got at this point? My answer to that is, if I'm not doing the Cisco exam, just give me a packet sniffer on the particular router and I'll tell you. But unfortunately, it is something that you guys need to be somewhat familiar with because it does come up. Trailers are used for error detection. Sorry, go ahead, Corey.
Oh, just to clarify then, the MAC address is only stripped off at the routers, but if it went from host to host, then it would still be the original host's MAC, right?
If the hosts are both on the same Ethernet, yes, that is correct. The source MAC address will be the source MAC address of the sending host, and the destination MAC address will be the destination MAC address of the destination host. If a host is acting as a router, then the MAC addresses will be stripped off and re-added.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, now, cyclic redundancy check. Anybody apart from Kevin know what they are?
It's a integrity check, right? Like error correction, basically.
Change the word correction to detection, and I'll give you full marks. Anybody else tell me what cyclic redundancy checks are used for, or has anyone else seen them in the wild?
I've seen them for downloads of especially large files, Linux distributions, and so on. And I guess from what I understand, the idea is there's a mathematical formula that's used when you look at the data to come up with a result, and if that result is not the same once you transfer the file, then you assume that it was corrupt somehow. Is that the basic idea?
That's pretty much how it works. And if there is actually a little chat where Ian goes through working out an example, a CRC, which is in the 2007 Thursday chats, basically what you do is you take a binary polynomial and you divide the data stream by the polynomial and you get a remainder, and because you're doing a binary long division, the remainder changes lots and lots and lots and goes all over the place. So the trick is that the bits that go through the CRC algorithm are meant to perturb or upset the remainder a lot, so that the probability that you will find that you will be able to send two pieces of data through with the same CRC is extremely low. However, it is worth noting that a CRC, the probability of a CRC collision, in other words, two data sets generating the same CRC, decreases the more data you decide to protect with a CRC. So if you're checking 1500 bytes with a CRC, or 2000 bytes with a CRC, or 2048 bytes with a CRC, then you are not that likely to get a CRC collision. But if you are checking, say, 100 megabytes with a CRC, then you will find that a 16-bit or a 32-bit CRC is not really sufficient to protect that level of data with any great, the probability of a CRC collision is possible. Now, the ones you will have seen with Linux distributions tend to be MD5 sums, or SHA1s, or SHA160s. They are actually a cryptographic hash algorithm, and because they have more bits in them than a CRC generally does, they are much more accurate at detecting whether there are errors in the data stream.
Yeah, that's a MD5 sum is the one I see all the time browsing.
Do you need another set of headphones, Grace? Oh, what's wrong with it?
The desktop's here.
We've just had somebody blow up the size of the desktop to 400%, and our volunteer's now having trouble seeing it. It's good when we get our own back on those sighted people. Okay, moving right along. Examples of data link protocols. Ethernet, point-to-point protocol, PPP, HDLC, high-level link data control, frame relay, ATM, and that's about what we've got. Okay, the next thing we have to talk about is that LANs use high bandwidth, small geographic area, and WANs use lower bandwidth technology and they use large geographic areas. The Ethernet is standardized by 802.2 and 802.3 standards. And you're looking at 10 megabits per second to 10 gigabit Ethernet. The frame format is the same across all different sorts of Ethernet. Okay, now the other thing is Ethernet does not acknowledge frames, but it does check them. So when you send a frame on the Ethernet, it checks whether the frame is valid. If the CRC fails, the frame is dropped. It is up to the higher level protocols. It needs to be. It's handled there.
So that's why you'd use like TCP.
That's exactly right. You would use TCP to make sure. Okay, we talked about wireless networks. There's no notion of MAC addresses as such on wireless networks. But usually they are sent over LANs, so that's when MAC addresses get stuck on as well. Frames are acknowledged on wireless. Hey, and that's the end of the notes. Look at that. Chapter 7. Any questions? Dave has cleaning stuff in the cafe if you need it. Sorry, go ahead.
So wireless networks then... they only use the MAC address more as a means of security. Not that it really keeps anyone away, but you can... That's the access control lists, and that's really all they use them for.
Well, if the wireless networks are... Well, see, a wireless network uses what we call a BSSID, which is usually set to something that looks like a MAC address, because most wireless networks are... are merged... onto Ethernet, then the MAC addresses do become important.
Oh, okay, so if the wireless network uses Ethernet as its media, like the actual frame is a Ethernet frame, then it behaves the same way.
Well, if you're running wireless network in isolation, you can get them to do different things, because you can actually have a frame up to 4,000 bytes on a wireless network. However, what actually happens is most of the time they are bridged to Ethernet, so that's why you normally do think that wireless networks do have MAC addresses on them.
Oh, okay.
Any other questions, comments? Apart from how not to turn Training Room 3 into Grand Central Station.
I think we got a little spoiled for a few weeks with the more fun practical exercise. Reality check, getting back to the theory.